This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll talk about the mastodon fossils that have scientists rethinking when humans first came to the Americas. Could Neanderthals have beat Homo sapiens here? We'll talk about it. It's kind of interesting. But first, last weekend, perhaps you were among the millions of people in 500 cities around the world who took to the streets on Earth Day for the March for Science. I watched the Washington, D.C. march in a very rainy capital, but it did not dampen the marchers' spirits. This week, another march, this one solely for the climate. Here to talk about plans for the People's Climate March and other selected short subjects in science is Annalee Newitz. She's the tech culture editor at Ars Technica in San Francisco. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Annalee, tell us about the climate march this weekend. Who is it for? What are they marching about?
So this is another science-related march. So if you liked last week's science march, it's great to come out again. Or if you missed it, it'll be a good thing to go to. But what makes this march different is that it's not just focusing on the science of climate and on environmental science, but also on the communities that are affected by climate policy. So the organizers are asking people to think about places like Flint, Michigan, for example, where people are struggling to have clean drinking water, and to think about poor communities, communities of color, places where people are directly affected by environmental policy. And so this is a march that's for the science, but also to think about how science affects people's everyday lives and even just the health of a community.
Is this one, would you count it as a more political one than last week's?
I don't really think so, because one of the things that came out of last week's march, I think, is that we realized how much science has been kind of unwittingly politicized.
Yeah.
And so I think now we're kind of in this new era where you can't think about science without politics.
Speaking about politics and government, you have a story about the early days of bureaucracy in the Americas. Where and when is it?
So this is about a city that was very bustling about 2,300 years ago in Oaxaca, which is in southern Mexico. And the city is called El Palenque, and a couple of archaeologists have unearthed enough of the downtown area of this city that they are able to actually see what the political structure was like just based on the architecture of these downtown buildings.
And what did they find out about it? Was it a palace for a king, or what was it?
So that's what's so cool about it, is that they found a palace, but it wasn't just for the king. So it's actually this enormous palace that's really two buildings. And part of it is just your standard kind of monarchy castle where the king lives with his family. He's got like a barbecue pit, lots of cool stuff. But then another part of the palace, which is quite enormous, is devoted entirely to meeting rooms, sacrifice rooms, and a big open area where the king and his advisors could address people who gathered in a plaza below. And so what this architecture tells us is that this palace that was running the city wasn't just for one guy telling everyone what to do. He had a whole complicated group of advisors, ministers, priests who were helping to run this city. And so we get a sense that they're right on the cusp of going from kind of an old school situation where a chief or a king is running things and a new situation, a state where a bureaucracy is running it.
Huh, that's kind of interesting. It's sort of an experiment in democracy or modern government.
It really is. And what's fascinating about it is that this is happening right around the same time that people in classical Greece were also experimenting with developing city-states. So you get this kind of nice sense of convergent evolution where two different cultures are kind of coming up with the same ideas about how to deal with what happens when there's lots and lots of people living together.
That is interesting.
Build a nation.
Build a nation. Let's change topics a bit. By just a few thousand years, you have a story about writing a film using artificial intelligence. You know, there's let's talk of a writer's strike in Hollywood. Do we not need that?
So this is actually the second film that these filmmakers have made with an AI who they've named Benjamin. And Benjamin's technical name is that he is a long short-term memory recursive machine learning algorithm. And that is just a fancy way of saying that Benjamin learns by Benjamin writes by creating long sentences based on a big body of writing that they gave him. And in this case, they gave him episodes of Knight Rider, the classic 1980s TV show about a man and his intelligent car.
Right.
And what happens is Benjamin is trying to predict what kinds of sentences might be written based on these episodes. And so what comes out is kind of, in some ways, sentences that sound exactly like what would happen in this TV show, and sometimes they sound like a little bit of a mush.
Activate Hoffbot.
Okay, pal, pick me up.
Dangerous world of a man who does not exist.
Hey, put a little button on that panel and do the control.
Michael, with increased speed, I'm sorry, I can't make it. That's okay, buddy.
That was fed from his 80s shows. The dialogue got all jumbled.
That's good. Who's the voice? It's sort of a familiar voice there.
Yeah, that is David Hasselhoff, who played the character, the main character in Knight Rider.
Without his Speedos on from Baywatch. Right.
He was wearing, they threw in a little Baywatch just to make it interesting. And he is, in fact, in the film, which is called It's No Game, he is wearing his shorts from Baywatch. So he's mixed it up a little.
Doesn't really sound totally realistic, that, so far. Needs some work, I think.
It does need some work, but what's great is that because of the way that Benjamin the AI learns, he's really good at picking out cliches from what he reads because he's trying to predict what people will say based on what they've said a lot in the past. And so the guy who wrote this film, Oscar Sharp, said it's really changed the way he writes to work with this AI because the AI just hones right in on any cliche. So maybe Benjamin has a future as like, sort of like an ad blocker, but for cliches. So he could be like a cliche blocker for screenwriters.
Finally, in a short time we have left, there's this news story about a caterpillar that eats plastic. And I mean, what's interesting is how they actually discovered this.
Yeah, so there's a scientist who works with bees. And one of the big problems is that worms called, their caterpillars called wax worms, sometimes come in and eat the honeycomb. So she was pulling these worms out and tossed them in a plastic bag and found out they were actually eating the bag and analyzed it and analyzed the worms by smooshing them up and analyzing them and found out that they're actually digesting plastic.
Wow. Polyethylene eating caterpillars.
That's right.
I can see the horror movie now coming to a theater near you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Annalie. Annalie Newitz is the tech culture editor at Ars Technica in San Francisco. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. What keeps you up at night? Is it your finances, your job, your health? Maybe you're worried because you're still awake worrying. Well, whatever it is that you're fretting about, there's a good bit of good news. Worrying can be beneficial under certain circumstances. Dr. Kate Sweeney is here to explain. She's Associate Professor of Psychology at the UC Riverside and co-author of new research on the upside of worrying. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
This might be sort of more of a bad thing, good thing. Worrying too much is still bad for us, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I'm sure no one will be particularly surprised to hear that most people find worry to be really unpleasant. And in fact, it has some pretty serious downsides that can lead to a depressed mood, difficulty concentrating, irritability, sleep disruption, even problems with our physical health.
Okay, so we know that, but you're also saying it can be good. How does that work?
That's right. After that big list, it's probably surprising that worry can do anything good for us at all, but it actually serves a few functions. So I think the most important function that worry serves is that it acts as a motivator. It essentially tells us there's something we should be doing, and it gives us the motivation to do it. So, for example, there have been studies showing that people who worry about getting in a car accident are more likely to wear their seatbelt. People who worry about getting skin cancer are more likely to wear sunscreen. So these are some pretty important benefits for our health. And the other way that worry can help us is that it's actually so unpleasant that it makes any other emotional experience feel kind of not so bad in contrast. So, for example, I've done studies with law graduates who are waiting to find out if they pass the bar exam, and the ones who worry a lot while they're waiting feel not so bad when they fail, and they feel extra great when they pass.
Hmm. So how can I turn my worry into more productive kind? Let's say I'm the type of person who lays awake at night sweating about today's show or the transportation system breaking down or something like that.
Yeah, so much to worry about. Well, the key, I think, is to kind of make sure that worry is actually doing you the favors that I just described instead of overwhelming you. So, for example, when I worry, and I am a pro-level worrier, there's a reason I study this, I kind of go through a mental checklist. Is there anything I could be doing to make sure that bad outcomes don't come my way? And even if they do, that I might be a little bit more prepared for them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if there's nothing I can be doing, if the answer to that checklist is nope, I've done everything I possibly can, all I can really try to do is to distract myself, try to keep my worry at a manageable level, and, you know, failing that, at least I know that I'll feel better about whatever happens because at least I don't have to worry anymore.
Yeah, that's in theory, that's it. are there people who don't worry at all about anything?
I would love to meet one. I don't think so. Probably not people who don't worry at all, but there are some people, I think, who worry relatively little and maybe not quite enough. You know, they're so laid back that they might not take preventive action to make sure that things go well. They may not plan fully. And worse, they might be really caught off guard if bad things do come their way, which no one is immune to bad news.
Well, so there's good news about worrying, but do you think worry warts are going to worry about not worrying if they don't worry?
I think those of us who worry know that we're pretty good at it and probably won't spend too much time worrying about our worry.
Okay, so I'm with you, Dr. Sweeney. I'm one of those worriers who, you know, I need something to worry about, so.
We'll take heart.
Yeah, we'll join together. Kate Sweeney, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of California, Riverside. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break, and after the break, the fossil find that has heads scratching, could humans have arrived in North America 100 years earlier than we thought? Some answers in your questions after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's November 1992. A paleontologist monitoring a freeway construction site in San Diego makes a startling and very lucky discovery. As he watches a caterpillar backhoe dig through the sandy soil, he spots bits of mastodon bones and teeth. It is an exciting and perhaps historic day on the job. Subsequent digs turn up heavy stones, which paleontologists now say could have been used as anvils and hammers to get at marrow in the bones or make bone tools. But nothing I've said so far is that unusual. Troves of old bones and tools they're found all over the world. But this is the thing. After over two decades of work, scientists finally got an age for those old bones, and wait for it, 130,000 years old in North America, a place where we thought humans didn't set foot until 15,000 years ago. 130,000? So this new find, it's 10 times older than that. Of course, as Carl Sagan used to like to say, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Joining me now to talk about that evidence is Kathy Holin. She is director of the Center for American Paleolithic Research in Hot Springs, South Dakota. She's one of the authors of a new study about the fossil finds out this week in the journal Nature. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Holin.
Oh, it's Kathy Holin. Thank you very much.
It's nice to have you. Also, Steve Holin is with us. He's director of research at the Center for American Paleolithic Research and a co-author on the Nature Study. Welcome to you, Steve.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here.
I imagine you two are connected somehow, husband and wife.
We are. Yeah. Yes, we are. Research partners and husband and wife.
Yeah. Let's talk about the research, Kathy. Let's start with what you have here. Give us a quick rundown on what exactly was found at the site.
Well, as you mentioned, we found mastodon bones, and from our experience, these were broken in patterns that usually are associated with human modification. They were broken while they were still fresh, and the fragments were found to be sort of clustered in two distinct areas around rocks. And we also noticed that there was a differential breakage pattern. What I mean by that is these heavy limb bones that are useful for making tools were smashed and broken up, but the lighter bones, like ribs and vertebra, were more complete. And so that right there gave us a clue that that something unusual was going on here. The other thing was that we found characteristic marks on the bone surfaces, notches and scars where flakes of bone had been removed. And this is characteristic of bone that is broken by what we call percussion, that is with hammer stones. And we also found cone flakes that these occur characteristically around the point of an impact, much like when you see a BB strike a window, those circular patterns break off in flakes, and we could find these. So again, we were seeing evidence that something had broken these bones by hitting them very hard. Then we found stones that were located right within the concentrations of the mastodon bone fragments and flakes. And the stones and bone fragments could be refit back together. So it showed that whatever happened, happened in the same location. And then we found marks on the rocks that were characteristic of them being used as pounding tools. And there was pounding evidence on both the rocks and also on the mastodon bones. And then we saw signs of human behavior at the site. For example, the location of one of the impacts suggests that there was cooperation between at least two people to steady this bone on an anvil and then break it. In addition to that, we ruled out natural causes for this to have happened, that we found no evidence that carnivores had modified the bones or that there had been a trampling event that had broken the bones. And there's no evidence of heavy flooding that would have caused the rocks to break the bones, because the heavy flooding would have washed away these smaller fragments that were right with the stones.
Steve, you and Kathy have actually done modern-day recreations of what happens when you hit fresh bones with rocks. Tell us about that.
Well, we've actually done two experiments breaking elephant limb bones. And the first one was in Tanzania, Africa, in 2006. We were allowed to get one femur out of a dead elephant, and we used a large rock to break this elephant femur on an anvil, and we reproduced the same kind of fracture patterns that we see on the Cerruti site mastodon limb bones. A second experiment, after we found out about the Cerruti site mastodon, we began this research with the other team in 2008. And in 2009, we got a zoo elephant that had died and broke some of the bones. And in this case, we used a 32.5-pound rock as a hammer and set the bone up on an anvil, and another person had to hold the bone on an anvil. So this is obviously a two-person event when you do these things. And I hit the bone four times with this hammer, and I'm not a real big guy, and I couldn't break it. I had to get a young, strong graduate student on there who was much more of a man than I am, and he hit it about four times before he first broke the bone. And again, we made the same kinds of impact notches and cone flakes that we see on the Cerruti site mastodon bone. We then sent the tips of some of these hammers to Australia to our co-author Richard Fulliger, who's an expert on use wear analysis on pounding tools, on rock hammers. And we didn't tell him how old this site was. We sent some of the rocks from the Cerruti mastodon site itself and then some of the rocks from our experiments. And he looked at the Cerruti site stones and sent them back and said, yes, these are stone tools definitely used to pound on bone, and they've also hit other rock. And then we told him how old the site was, and he was quite astounded.
We talked with an independent expert on the type of uranium dating used in this study, Warren Sharp of the Berkeley Geochronology Center. Here's what he had to say about the dates determined in the work.
Basically, we have to believe the date. The date is not the question in this study. There have been lots of people that have claimed that they had some kind of archaeological evidence for people earlier than, you know, 15,000 years ago or so. But if this really passes muster, then I think all of those sites and all of those claims are going to be looked at with new eyes, and people are going to not just dismiss them out of hand.
Amazing. We have actual pictures of the specimens and a link to the study up on our website, sciencefriday.com/mastodon, sciencefriday.com/mastodon. Of course, even if we believe the dates, there's still the other question. Can we say unequivocally that this was done by humans or human relatives without finding their remains? We didn't find any remains at the site. I'd like to bring on someone who wasn't involved in the study but who has experience analyzing bones left over from ancient dinners, a lot of them. Brianna Pobiner is a paleoanthropologist at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So your first thoughts when you saw the results?
So my first thoughts were not so much what's there, but what's not there. And I think what I'm looking for, what I would be looking for, what I don't see are two things that are real smoking guns of human involvement. The first is cut marks on the animal bones. So usually if there's butchery for meat, or even if there's scraping off of tissue like periosteum or connective tissue to be able to get to the bones to break them open, you would expect to see cut marks by sharp stone tools. And the other thing is those sharp stone tools themselves. So most butchery sites that we see in other areas of the world that are this age or older that have evidence of butchery by humans have both those sharp stone knives and the cut marks. And so that, to me, I just gives me pause and makes me think about it a little bit more and just gives me question.
Well, could it have been an animal? You know, an animal done it with teeth marks, saber-toothed tiger, something like that?
Well, so I've seen a lot of what happens when hyenas and other predators chew on bones, and I would say no. So I think the team has done a good job of ruling out that I don't think there's carnivore involvement here. They tend to chew on the ends of bones, and they can't really break open right at the midshaft the bones of big animals. But there is evidence in studies by particularly Gary Haynes, who recently retired from the University of Nevada, Reno, has done a lot of studies looking at what happens when elephants trample on bones. And in one study, he noticed from natural elephant bone sites in southern Africa that up to 62% of elephant limb bones are spirally fractured. And so I think we can't say necessarily because the bones have this green or fresh or spiral fracture that it definitely means human involvement.
Kathy, let's say for a second that these are, you know, this fine 130,000-year-old bones are correct, as you seem to be saying. Who did the butchering? I mean, were they Homo sapiens? Could they be one of our human cousins, Neanderthal, something like that? I mean, we only thought that people were in the Americas 15,000 years ago.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to clarify that we have never claimed that the Siam mastodon was butchered. In fact, we believe that the bones broken were essentially a quarry site, where that is, people were coming and utilizing the bone, harvesting the bone to be used. And so the absence of cut marks and manufactured tools is because it was not being used for that purpose. The animal was not killed and butchered. But we do have some candidates that might be the agents of this breakage, and we're just speculating here because, in fact, the real truth is we do not know. Candidates could have been, though, Neanderthals or the Denisovans and even archaic humans, but this site will never demonstrate that. We don't have enough evidence from the CM site, which is why we need to go out and find more sites.
You think there are more out there?
Yes.
Well, do you have evidence for that, that you're ready to go or you found something you don't want to tell us about yet?
Well, I'll let Steve answer that.
We have some preliminary evidence from another site, but it's very preliminary and we can't talk about it at this point.
Oh, no one's listening. Come on, you can just...
No, we have to keep this quiet, just like the press embargo on the Nature letter.
Yeah. Plus, I know somebody's listening because I told my family.
Well, is it near the same site? Where were these bones found? I don't think we had quite mentioned where they were found.
The mastodon bones?
Yeah, the mastodon.
They were found along a highway project in San Diego, in the city of San Diego.
Wow, that's amazing. Have we done thorough excavations of this era of time in other places in the Americas? Is it possible there outside of San Diego there are other fossils this old just hiding out there waiting to be discovered?
Yeah, I think that's one of the issues about sites of this age. Typically, archaeologists don't look in settings of this age. And paleontologists who do look in sites of this age are not really looking for sites or evidence of human involvement. And so what we have is a site that sort of falls in between the two disciplines. And what this project did for me was show how valuable it is to have interdisciplinary people working together on one site where we're all bringing our experience and knowledge and our ability to see things in different ways and collaborating until we find an answer. Believe me, all of us on the team were skeptical. We wanted to get evidence and gather evidence to support what we were seeing, what we couldn't believe was there, the evidence that appeared to us to show human involvement at this site.
I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about these 130,000-year-old fossils, Dr. Pobiner, you work at the Smithsonian. Could there be other specimens sitting in your museum, old fossils anywhere else, too, we might want to re-examine in light of this study?
Oh, definitely. I actually think that looking in museum collections, which tend to be troves of treasure waiting to be rediscovered, would be a great idea. There's a site from Maryland, actually, called the Inglewood Site, where there's a mammoth that was 24,000 years old, and there was a reexamination of those fossils recently, and it looks like those bones from that mammoth were green or spiral fractured, probably because of the heavy earth-moving equipment that was used in part of the excavation of the site. So I think, the Englewood mammoth and other places and looking at other museum collections is definitely a way to go. I also think looking potentially for protein or blood residues on the stone tools to see if there's anything left from if the mammoth was fresh when if it was broken open, as well as there was a paper that came out yesterday where a research team actually found DNA from Neanderthals and Denisovans in the dirt in a cave. So let's try that. I think if we're going to look for evidence of human involvement, let's throw everything we can at it. It's a compelling idea, but I think we need to find more evidence.
Well, so what kind of evidence? Do you actually have to find the DNA evidence? I'm looking for the rewrite the textbook level convincing evidence here.
Well, I think, again, stone tools, and I know even if it's not a site where mammoths were being butchered, we might still expect to potentially find other marks from stone implements in order to do that processing, like percussion marks as opposed to just percussion fracture. But I think the tools of humans would be a smoking gun to just add to the evidence.
You know, we think about humans coming over that land bridge, Steve Holland. Did humans or relatives maybe have sophisticated boat-making skills 130,000 years ago?
Well, we think there are two possible options for humans to get into North America at that time. The land bridge was open until about 130,000 years ago when rising sea levels, because of melting glaciers, closed the Bering land bridge. So if people came in, another option is that people had good watercraft by this time. There's evidence on the island of Crete based on hand axes found in 130,000-year-old geological deposits. The humans arrived there, and there's never been a land bridge there, so they had to have some kind of watercraft to get there. Also in Indonesia, on the island of Sulawesi, sometime between 118,000 and 190,000 years ago, humans arrived at that island, and they had to get there by some kind of watercraft. So we know people had that technology at the time, and when the climate started warming about 135,000 years ago, they surely could have followed the coast of Asia north and then followed the west coast of North America south and arrived in beautiful California.
Yeah, we saw some evidence last week, a couple weeks ago, about parts of the Pacific Northwest which were above sea level all during that time, and only an island people would have to have gotten there. A great topic for further discussion. Let me thank my guests. Brianna Pobiner is paleoanthropologist at the Smithsonian. Kathy Holland, director of the Center for American Paleolithic Research in Hot Springs, South Dakota. And Steve Holland, director of research at the Center for the American Paleolithic Research. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And just a reminder, we have pictures of the specimens and a link to the study. It's up on our website at sciencefriday.com/mastodon, sciencefriday.com/mastodon. We're going to take a break. When we come back, a new kind of smart television, a new series on National Geographic about Albert Einstein. Stay with us. Walter Isaacson will join us after this break. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When I say Albert Einstein, the first thing that comes to mind is what? An image of messy gray hair, E equals MC squared. That is the Einstein we know as the scientist. But what do we know about Einstein, the person? The father of modern physics was also humorous, irreverent, romantic, impatient, and a musician, because he was, after all, human. And that human side of Einstein is what's on display in National Geographic's new series, Genius, based on a 2007 biography by Walter Isaacson, Einstein, His Life and Universe. And Walter joins us now. He's president and CEO of the Aspen Institute also. Very busy guy, Walter. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
It's always good to be back with you, Ira. Thank you.
You're welcome. Your biography did an excellent job of marrying Einstein, the scientist, with Einstein, the person, his human attributes. How well do you think Genius, the video, is portraying the same dynamic?
Well, I think it's great because with Einstein, there was sort of a unified field theory between his personality, which was rebellious and impish and sometimes, you know, quite human, and his science, which was also very rebellious and visualized things. So I think that when you see him with the passions he had as a human being and also the passions he had as a scientist, it works together well. Both Jeffrey Rush, who plays the older Einstein, and Johnny Flynn, they really capture what I hope to put in the book, which was that connection of the personal to the science.
Yeah, I mean, you made me go back and read chapters in your book with just to look at the stuff I was seeing on the screen. It was very well done. And in particular, the second episode focused on the women in his life. Was the intent to make these women more central characters to show the humanity? And also, what was evident is the struggle that women had trying to become scientists in those days.
Well, exactly, especially Mileva Marich, who's, you know, is in that second episode. She was the only woman in the physics class of Einstein at the Zurich Polytech, and Einstein falls madly in love with her. They have an illegitimate child, then they go on and get married and have two children, but she also serves as a sounding board, especially with the mathematics of special relativity. Now, you know, it was pretty amazing for her to do that as a woman, a Serbian woman, in Switzerland at the time. And I think that's captured very well in this movie.
Yeah, because he says that's what, you know, he's falling in love with her because for her brain, basically.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with all due respect to Mileva Marich, she certainly was better known for her brains than her looks. I mean, she had a bit of a limp. She was not. But Einstein fell totally in love with her because she had one of those amazing sort of visual minds that could look at Maxwell's equations and figure out how a light wave would look if you tried to catch up with it. All those things that Einstein was trying to do. And so it's very inspiring, I hope, for women. As I do a couple of chapters on Mileva Marich in my book, because I believe that's important. I don't think this movie overplayed it.
You know, let me ask you, as a journalist and someone who writes about scientists, we're seeing a lot of famous scientists in films these days, you know, from Alan Turing to Stephen Hawking to Einstein. We're seeing science on television and the Big Bang Theory in popular culture. What is driving all of this new interest?
Well, this is wonderful, right?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's Science Friday is finally caught on and everybody wants to emulate you. I actually do think that it's really great that we're making heroes out of scientists. I think for a long time, and Einstein's partly to blame for this, you know, beginning in the 20s and 30s and 40s, science seemed to be very, very difficult, something that an ordinary person couldn't understand. Quantum theory, relativity, the two great theories that Einstein created. And so science became intimidating. But in a day and age in which technology and science and the connection of science to creativity is what's driving our economy, I think people realize, oh, yeah, it would be useful to know what the most innovative and what the most creative scientists thought like. So it's like Sputnik. It's sort of, I think, the digital revolution has helped kick up a notch the interest in science.
Well, the Sputnik certainly kicked up a notch the interest in politics back in the 60s. Do you think these films and series can influence in a more positive way how politicians view science?
It would be very important for that to happen. I urge anybody who's watching the series or reading my book and they say, wow, this is amazing, to realize that if you cut off the National Science Foundation, if you cut off basic research at universities or really reduce the dollars, we will not have people understand the application, say, of quantum theory to semiconducting materials. So you won't end up with transistors and microchips. Science is the seed corn that allows us to have wonderful inventions. So I hope this interest in science will cause people from Congress to local constituents to say, why would we decimate science in America?
Mm-hmm. Let me turn back to some of your other books, and in particular, your book about innovators, which I just loved also. Why was Einstein not included in one of those chapters on innovators? What set him apart from the, you know, Steve Jobs and these other people in that book?
Well, first of all, Einstein was very much theoretical. He didn't try to apply, say, quantum theory or relativity to do things that other people, like at Bell Labs, create, you know, lasers and microchips and GPS systems, all of these things that derive from Einstein's theories. Secondly, I wrote the innovators as sort of a balance to Einstein because the innovators is about teamwork. It's about how people collaborate in order to apply science. Einstein is one of the rare examples of somebody who was rather a loner in the pursuit of his science, partly because of the anti-Semitism that you see both in the movie and in my book and others. He didn't have close colleagues at the Prussian Academy, but Einstein was less of an applied innovator than he was somebody who saw the beauty of nature's brushstrokes in a theoretical sense.
It's beautifully captured in your book, of course, and in the National Geographic series, Genius. Walter, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, as always. You're always welcome.
It's always good to be back, Ira. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. Walter Isaacson, president and CEO of the Aspen Institute and author of the book Einstein, His Life and Universe. To best describe this next story, you need to imagine an artichoke. An artichoke. Now, visualize putting that artichoke on a turntable with its stem right in the center spindle. Now that's set up in your mind. Get the center spindle turning. You flash a strobe light as it's spinning. And if you spin the artichoke and flash the strobe at the right speed, the artichoke leaves will look like they are growing, that they are animated. And the secret to this phenomenon? It's math, of course, something called the golden ratio. There is an artist creating sculptures based on this math and on this effect. Our video producer, Luke Roskin, is here to get to the artichoke heart. Get it? Heart. Sorry, Luke. Of the matter, it's the subject of our latest video. And if you haven't seen the video yet, you have to check this out at sciencefriday.com. Luke has done great videos, but this one is a mind bender.
It's mesmerizing.
It is. Yeah, that's right. You sit there and you look at this.
You can watch it for a very long time. It has, and that's kind of the point. It's animations of sculptures that are never ending.
So why does it look like it's blooming based on this golden ratio?
Okay, so there's a lot of things to unpack to understand how these are blooming. So this is the work of John Edmark, and the sculptures you're referring to is what he calls his Blooms series. And it looks like it's blooming because he's constructed them like a frame of animation, like a single cell of animation. So each side of it is, he's placed the different elements of these blooms. They look like an artichoke, the head of an artichoke, or a cactus, or sometimes these kind of abstract, like koosh ball kind of shapes. And he places each of the elements based on what you just described before, the golden ratio, more specifically the golden angle. So it's the spiral form of the golden ratio. And each of those elements, when it's spun around using a strobe, like a light strobe, you only see one specific element at a time. But he's placed them in such a way that it looks like they're moving. And depending on how he, how far away from the golden ratio, the golden angle, he places them, he can get them to move and wiggle and kind of finesse and vibrate. It's really mesmerizing.
So I see you need that flashing strobe to sort of capture the movement or create the animation
yes.
part.
Yes, either that or you need to set your camera shutter to be very, really, really high. If you're taking this on video, you have to set your shutter that way.
Sort of like the wagon wheels on the trains in the movies. They spin around.
Exactly.
The shutter is flashing.
Exactly. So you can get this sensation that it's not moving in that case, or that it's moving very very slowly when in fact it's moving very fast. He's manipulating the kind of rotation like that. But in this case, he's making these blooms that look like they're constantly in motion, and the motion never ends.
And so he likes spirals. He's chosen spirals.
Yes, yeah, spirals are kind of his inspiration. They have this powerful geometric this powerful geometry, and they also have this beautiful aesthetic, but it's more than that. There's a philosophy behind his use of spirals. This is how John Edmark describes his kind of fascination.
Spirals make reference to the fact that you can never return to the same place again, that nothing ever does truly repeat. It goes infinitely small, and it goes infinitely large. It's endless. And, you know, we sort of don't know where we came from, and we don't know where we're going, and we're just sort of this, you know, this piece of that larger picture.
Describe for us what the spirals look like when you make them.
Well, they come in many forms, and if you go into his studio, you see these kind of wooden towers that are built up of all these layers, and he can manipulate them one layer at a time at exactly 137.5 degrees, the golden angle, and it creates this kind of beautiful motion. He also has these kind of like childlike toy inventions that he's made called the lollipopter that starts off as like a DNA helix, and just with a flick of the wrist, it suddenly becomes this kind of wooden Christmas tree kind of like structure, and it's all, you can hold it in your hand. He has these spiral tentacles that are made of wood that he can just by expanding or contracting or pulling a lever, they kind of unfurl. So the spirals and the geometry and the mathematics are just everywhere. You can experience it throughout all of his work. And then, of course, there are these 3D printed blooms, which are crowding a desk, a table, and they're just coming so many different shapes. And they don't look like any. They just look like gorgeous little statuettes. But when they move, man.
I spin them around.
Yeah.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with our video editor, Luke Ruskin, about these spirals. So he makes each one of these by hand? Does he 3D print them? How does he make them?
So he uses them. He designs them all on a computer, and he places all the elements in a computer. You could not achieve the level of symmetry and perfection and detail work by hand. You just couldn't do that. So everything's done by computer, and then he exports it and puts it into a 3D printer, and he prints out these blooms. And then in the case of, say, his wooden, kind of more wooden structures, he actually ends up basically laser cutting them out of wood.
Wow, it's amazing. And of course, we can see this golden ratio in nature, right? Besides just the...
Yes. So
artichoke we have.
Yeah. So if you know about this ratio, this famous golden angle or the golden ratio, it's really famous. If you look at a nautilus shell, that is a shell that structure of that follows the golden angle. And if you look at, say, galaxy formation or like we've talked about artichokes or my favorite is the Romanescu broccoli.
Broccoli?
Yeah.
Spinning broccoli?
Well, it looks like this fractal broccoli. You can find it at a farmer's market usually. And it's this, if you spin that, then you get that sort of structure.
All right. Let's see. Let's go to the phones. We have a caller or two. Let's go to Michael in Cincinnati. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Ira. Wonderful to be on.
Thank you. You're welcome.
I'm an engraver, and I run tools called Rose Engines. They're lathes that have rocking spindles, and we engrave, think of pocket watches. We engrave probably the most common patterns called a barley, after a barley or wheat, where we're cutting equal radials from the center out. And it imitates, it's not Fibonacci, it's not that actual, but it imitates and looks very much like what you're talking about. And light moves around on the engraving anytime you move it in equal radials. There's also a great video of a guy with a bowl on a potter's wheel, and he paints wet slip into it, and then as it's spinning, depending on the speed, as he drags his finger up and down, he gets the same strobe effects that you're talking about. They're just, it's absolutely mesmerizing.
Wow. Well, thanks for calling.
Yeah, it's a very, using math and using spirals and using these kind of naturally curling geometries can have some really powerful aesthetic effects. And, you know, when John Edmark was talking about this, he talked about his inspiration and how, you know, it's not like spinning an artichoke has never happened. It's not like nobody knew that there weren't spiral structures in an artichoke. And that's kind of where his joy comes from, is kind of discovering that if he just puts a camera there and he spins it on a lathe, he can do that. He can create that. And then he can recreate it in his own work.
And he sells his artwork. You can buy it if you want.
Yeah, you could buy it. I think you can actually 3D print it if you go to his website, johnedmark.com. There's ways to actually make it yourself, and you can actually buy these structures. It's pretty cool. And if you don't have the money for it, then absolutely check out the video.
The video is up on our website?
Yeah, it's on sciencefriday.com. If you like our videos, then you can become a monthly supporter now of our videos. Become a patron. It's right there on the video page.
That's great. Luke Ruskin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
One last thing. For years, scientists have been trying to identify the precise combination of elements for the perfect night of fun. And finally, we think we just got the right formula. Geeks plus beer plus science trivia equals a nerdtacular night out. So join us for our third annual Science Friday Trivia Night at the Bell House in Brooklyn. That's Wednesday, May 10th. Circle the calendar. If you still do those things. Wednesday, May 10th, Science Friday Trivia Night at the Bell House in Brooklyn. You can go to sciencefriday.com/trivia for tickets and information. sciencefriday.com/trivia for tickets. They sell out, so you're going to want to get to that site Wednesday, May 10th. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here of the studios of City University of New York, our production partners. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.